From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today we talk with British actor Hugh Laurie, the star of the medical mystery TV series House. The series concludes next month after 8 seasons. As Dr. House, Laurie portrays a brilliant diagnostician who's abrasive and condescending. He's also in constant pain because of a chronic leg condition, which has led to problems with dependence on Vicodin. Portraying House, Hugh Laurie had to learn to walk with a limp and a cane. After getting so used to playing House, the first time he took a different role,
the director called action, and I started limping. And I think that's a bigger problem for me now, is that I just have a Pavlovian response to cameras. If I see a camera or if someone says action, I will start limping.
Hugh Laurie talks about House, learning to speak American, and getting started in Britcoms, coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Subaru, introducing the all-new Subaru Impreza. Love, it's what makes a Subaru. Learn more at Subaru.com. From Angie's List, with reviews on local contractors and doctors in 500 categories with ratings based only on member feedback, AngiesList.com. And from Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information available at Progressive.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After 8 seasons, the medical mystery series House will show its final episode May 21st. My guest is the star, Hugh Laurie. He directed the episode that will be shown next Monday. Laurie is a British actor who first became known to Americans for his work in the British comedy series Blackadder and Jeeves and Wooster. As Dr. Gregory House, Laurie plays a brilliant diagnostician who consults on the most mysterious cases at a teaching hospital in Princeton, New Jersey. The doctors and patients pay a big price for his genius. House is abrasive and condescending. His own medical problem is unsolvable. He's in constant leg pain and walks with a cane. It's led to serious problems with a dependency on Vicodin. At the heart of each episode of House is a patient stricken with a mysterious, life-threatening problem which is misdiagnosed until House figures out the cause. Some of the cases are comic, like this one from the 2004 series premiere, when House was sent to diagnose a man at the hospital clinic who had turned orange. Here's the patient.
I was playing golf and my cleats got stuck. I mean, it hurt a little, but I kept playing. The next morning, I could barely stand up. Well, you're smiling, so I take it that means this isn't serious. What's that? What are you doing?
Painkillers.
Oh, for you, for your leg.
No, because they're yummy. You want one? Make your back feel better. Unfortunately, you have a deeper problem. Your wife is having an affair.
What?
You're orange, you moron. It's one thing for you not to notice, but if your wife hasn't picked up on the fact that her husband has changed colors, she's just not paying attention. By the way, do you consume just a ridiculous amount of carrots and megadose vitamins? Carrots turn you yellow, then niacin turns you red. Find some finger paint and do the math. And get a good lawyer.
In this season's premiere episode, House was in prison for having driven his car into the home of the woman who had just left him, his boss, Dr. Lisa Cuddy. But even in prison, he's diagnosing a mysterious illness. A fellow inmate seems to have had an allergic reaction that left him unable to breathe until House performed an on-the-spot, unauthorized tracheotomy. In this scene, House has finagled his way into the prison clinic to see the patient after figuring out the cause was not a food allergy.
It wasn't the food. It was the heat. It's mastocytosis. Set off by hot liquids like the coffee he just drank.
Masto is usually a skin disease.
Usually? It can hit any organ. Joint pain, osteopenia, anaphylaxis, eyebrow loss. It fits.
That's a possibility. I'll run some blood tests. Thank you.
No, no. It's almost impossible to confirm masto with blood work. Just give him 5 aspirin.
If he has masto, he'll go into anaphylactic shock and won't be able to breathe again.
You do understand. The meaning of the word confirm.
I'll do it. I almost died in that cell.
House, you're in here because you think you can do whatever you want, whenever you want. You can't. And neither can I. The ACLU would have my job, my license, maybe even my house if I do an unauthorized experimental.
If it is masto.
It's not.
Well, what do you have to lose by giving him the aspirin?
I'm not taking the risk.
It's his risk to take. If he has another attack and there isn't a doctor in the next cell, he could die. So for 1 second, will you stop covering your ass and do the test?
I think House is right.
No.
You're a moron and a coward. I'll do it myself.
Guard. You're done here. Just like every other place you've ever set foot in your life.
Hugh Laurie, welcome to Fresh Air. I love that even in prison, you're treating patients and calling people morons.
I am calling people morons wherever I can, yes.
So it's going to be weird. I'm sure everybody tells you this in America. It's going to be weird hearing you in your own voice because I'm so used to you as House with the American accent. The first time I heard you in your own voice, I couldn't believe it.
Well, thank you. I suppose that's a good thing. But yes, I am. I'm not playing house today. So I am dressed as an Englishman, speaking as an Englishman. I'm wearing a bowler hat, if anyone's interested, and carrying a furled umbrella. Yes, it is. It's nice to have a day off every now and then.
So, if you wanted to do this interview in American, and I'm not suggesting that you do that, could you do that? Do you know American well enough to just improvise your way through it?
Yes, I think I do, but I have to have all sorts of emergency backup plans. If I see a word coming along that I know I can't do well, I have to find an alternative very, very quickly. I read the other day that people who stutter and stammer have the same mechanism where they see a problematic word hoving into view and they have to line up three or four alternatives to go to if it doesn't come out right the first time. And I have to do the same thing if I'm just sort of ad-libbing.
Are there certain words that you know will trip you up in American?
Yes. Can't say New York, so I don't go there.
Because I would say it New York with an N-O-O as opposed to N-Y-O-O.
Yes, I don't know if it's the New or the York or the two of them together. I don't know what it is, but it just scares me silly. So I can't say it and I don't go there. Murder I can't say and I don't do it. I tend to avoid murder. What are other ones? Court orders. I don't issue them or receive them because they also scare me silly. I suppose it's R's. R's are the problematic letters. But I do find that I can't think of a single word or even a syllable that really comes out the same in English and American.
You directed the episode of House that will be shown next week. It's the second time you've directed an episode. Why did you want to direct it?
Well, it's directing is the best job going. I don't really understand why everybody doesn't want to direct. It's an absolutely fascinating combination of skills required and puzzles set on every possible level, emotional and practical and technical. It calls upon such a wide variety of skills. I find it completely absorbing and... The only thing that had held me back was that there's a worry that it compromises my ability to do my main job, which is to play the role of House.
So do you direct yourself any differently than other directors do? Is there anything you're going to be doing under your own direction that is different?
Usually, I suppose I, as an actor, then pay the price of getting behind on time, whereas I might demand of another director, I feel as if I need more time to do this again and again and again. When I'm directing and I've got to have an eye on the clock, I won't give myself that time. I'll see if I can get it right once or maybe twice, and then we have to move on because I want to devote time elsewhere. So I'm sort of shortchanging myself in a way. But I also I defer to others. You know, if I'm doing a scene with Robert Sean Leonard, he's a man I would put my life in his hands and almost have on occasion. And I would say to him, you know, did that seem all right to you? And he will definitely say, not quite. Or he'll say, yes, no, that was great. You've got it. So, you know, I defer to others around me. They're a fantastic bunch of people, and I trust them completely.
So, House is ending at the end of this season. Why is it ending, and did you have a vote in that?
Yes, I did have a vote, although it never really came to that, you know, the paper, scissors, stone moment. It was a sort of a consensus that we had run our course, and it occurred to me the other day that I suppose one of the problems is that the character is so inherently self-destructive to the point of being virtually suicidal. A person cannot be a character, a fictional character cannot sustain that suicidal tension indefinitely. You can't have a man on a window ledge threatening to jump forever. At some point, he's either got to jump or get back into the building because the crowd below, who are either urging him to jump or not jump, eventually will lose interest. And I think that because the tension must dissipate eventually. And in actual fact, at the point we're going to leave the show, it's a Hamlet moment. It's a to be or not to be. It's House deciding whether to embrace life or death. But having made that decision, and I won't tell you what that decision is, having made it, I think it's time for us to move on. I think it is the right time.
Well, so House is either going to take his life or be resigned to life as he knows
it, too much?
And maybe even cheer up. Nah, he's not going to cheer up.
Right. Well, cheering up, I don't know. He's obviously, there are some obstacles to that. But, you know, all things are relative. There's a relatively cheerful House. I've always enjoyed the sort of playfulness of the character. I've always found that there is a playful child in there somewhere. For all his cynicism and sarcasm, I think there is a child there who delights in silly wordplay and pranks and practical
making people
jokes
squirm.
Yes, and you know it's sometimes obnoxious, but it's sort of I find it quite endearing sometimes in someone of such manifest intelligence, so obviously gifted, that to see someone behaving in such a plainly childish fashion, I find rather endearing.
So you've spent the better part of the past 8 years playing someone in constant physical pain, and the pain has affected how you walk with a limp and a cane. It's affected your personality, which is just kind of bitter, cynical, grudging, resentful. So let's talk about that for a moment. Did you feel like you needed to really understand the exact nature of House's injury and know exactly what movements would increase the pain and exactly how severe the pain was in order to play it?
I did the best that I could. I think pain is it's an extremely hard thing to empathize moment to moment. You often can't remember your own pain. You know, that moment that you broke a limb or that you burned yourself, or I think this is a common thing that women talk about with childbirth, that the memory of the pain is hard to summon up and relive, thankfully. But then, of course, that very quickly has to take the back seat to the more pressing demands of how do you stage a scene? What is the best thing for a scene? And sometimes, you know, it has just been necessary for House to be more nimble than other times. It is just dramatically more important that he can skip over that desk with a certain amount of agility and brio. Never mind the fact that he's obviously dragging a severely damaged leg with him. So it's a constant mixture of things from moment to moment, trying to make a judgment about what is believable, what is an accurate presentation of this, the pain that he's suffering, but also what actually plays a scene in the best possible way.
What impact has it had on your spine and your leg to walk with a limp so much?
I am horribly, horribly damaged, and let that be my opening statement in a massive lawsuit, which I am plotting. But my sport of choice when I was a young man was rowing, or crew, as I think you call it over here. And I always I rowed with the oar on one side, on the stroke side, which meant my body was twisting in the same direction many, many thousands of times a day under stress for about 15 years. And I think that's given me a permanent kink. I do remember, though, I had an acting engagement outside of House. It was a film called Street Kings, and the first scene I did, oddly enough, was set in a hospital, and the director called action, and I started limping. And I think that's a bigger problem for me now, is that I just have a Pavlovian response to cameras. If I see a camera or if someone says action, I will start limping. I don't think I'll be able to walk straight now.
I just hope you have a good chiropractor to undo favoring one leg.
Yes, they've got their work cut out for them, I think.
My guest is Hugh Laurie, the star of the medical mystery series House, which will show its final episode May 21st. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. you're just joining us, my guest is Hugh Laurie, who stars in the series House, and this is the last season, and next week's episode is directed by Hugh Laurie as well as starring him. So you wrote a novel in 1996 called The Gunseller, and there's a paragraph all about pain that I want you to read for us. And you have that paragraph with you, right?
I do. I travel with...
we faxed it to you, yes. We did fax it to you.
I don't. I don't carry my own novel around. That would be
just in case.
Obnoxious, I think.
And I should say here, just to set it up, that there's a really large man in this section who is trying to break your arm. And he's trying to do it really, really slowly to increase the length of pain and the intensity of your pain.
A one-armed combat instructor called Cliff. Yes, I know, he taught unarmed combat and he only had one arm. Very occasionally life is like that. Once told me that pain was a thing you did to yourself. Other people did things to you. They hit you or stabbed you or tried to break your arm. But pain was of your own making. Therefore, said Cliff, who'd spent 2 weeks in Japan and so felt entitled to unload manure of this sort on his eager charges, it was always within your power to stop your own pain. Cliff was killed in a pub brawl 3 months later by a 55-year-old widow, so I don't suppose I'll ever have a chance to set him straight. Pain is an event. It happens to you, and you deal with it in whatever way you can.
So that's Hugh Laurie from reading from his 1996 novel, The Gunseller. You know, reading that and thinking about how much pain House is in all the time made me wonder, like, what's the worst physical pain you ever experienced?
When I was about, I think, 10 years old, I made a petrol bomb. Well, I thought of it then. A friend, there were two of us, and we thought of it at the time as a Molotov cocktail. That sounded so exotic and exciting. And it went wrong. And I got burning petrol on myself and burnt my leg quite badly. And my father, who was a doctor, and he treated me, it was just one of those rare times, he was massively unsympathetic because I think he was so furious at the idea that I'd been playing with burning petrol. And it's a fair point. And I can remember sort of yelling at the top of my voice, it hurts, it hurts. And he said, yes, it will. And that was a lesson learned. I think that was the most extreme pain I've been. Burns are, as is commonly known, burns are can generate quite extraordinary degrees of pain, and that was the worst that I can remember. Then there are other kinds of pain. I suppose the pain of rowing, I think, which is something you deliberately submit to. You try and load upon yourself, because the more you can endure, the further ahead of your opponent you'll get. That's probably, or that would probably come second in my litany of pain.
Did being a rower help teach you how to put pain aside and just focus on what you wanted to do?
I don't know. Maybe it did, or maybe I already had that sort of slightly masochistic cast of mind, and therefore that suited me to the sport, because I can remember at school I used to sit in class, and just to while away an idle hour, I would induce cramp in my I still to this day can induce cramp in my feet and legs, just to see how long I could stand it. I don't know why. It's rather odd, isn't it?
It is. I mean, really, actually, really odd. Cramps in feet, yeah, and legs are so uncomfortable.
Yes, well, I can and do induce it.
You still do that?
I do.
Wow, that's really weird,
odd,
if you don't mind my saying.
No, it is a bit weird. Yes, it is. And sometimes, if there's a bucket of ice about, and occasionally in life there is, if I see a bucket of ice, I'm quite tempted to give it a go and see if I can put a stopwatch on it. I am a bit twisted, as I mentioned earlier. But I'm sure it'll all be all right in the end.
Because House is in constant pain, he's had really bad problems with Vicodin addiction. Did you do research on Vicodin and the long-term effects it would have?
I did research into the short-term effects, which were very pleasurable. And by the way, this was not within the borders of the United States. I'm just making that perfectly plain, but I took it for recreational purposes. Well, that's to say I was not in pain when I took it, so that counts, I suppose, as recreational. And the effects on the body are quite different if you're not actually suffering pain, so I understand. It's just a sort of pleasant, wafty feeling, extremely pleasant, and I can imagine highly addictive, but it's quite different, I think, if you're suffering extreme pain, you take it for analgesic reasons. I think it behaves quite differently. And, of course, its long-term effects, I obviously couldn't research that without doing serious damage to my internal organs. So,
there's always the internet.
although I love my craft, I don't love it that much. There is, yes, and there are many stories to be told. But it is obviously a very, very serious problem in his life and many people's lives. I mean, it is alarmingly easy for people to stumble into a dependence on painkillers. You know, from the most trivial surgical procedures, somebody might take a couple of pills, and then their life is never the same again.
Hugh Laurie will be back in the second half of the show. He stars in the series House and directed next week's episode. There's just a few episodes left. The series concludes May 21st. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This is NPR.
Coming up, finding the voice for Dr. House. More of our interview with Hugh Laurie, star of the medical mystery series House, which is wrapping up its final season. We're listening to Laurie playing piano from his album Let Them Talk.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Pew Charitable Trusts, working to ensure access to safe and healthy foods at school at pewtrusts.org. From the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation, supporting leadership, innovation, and collaboration for a better New Jersey. More at grdodge.org. And from Carnegie Corporation of New York, a foundation created to do what Andrew Carnegie called real and permanent good, celebrating 100 years of philanthropy.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Hugh Laurie, the star of the medical mystery series House, which will show its final episode May 21st. Hugh Laurie directed next week's episode. As Dr. Gregory House, Laurie portrays a brilliant diagnostician at a hospital who deals with patients who will die unless he can figure out the cause of their mysterious problems.
Your father is a doctor, or I'm actually not sure if he's still alive, so I'm not sure how to phrase
this. He's not still alive. No, and he was a doctor.
He was a doctor.
Yeah.
So he passed before House?
Yes.
Do you think about him when you play House? Because you grew up with a genuine doctor.
Many times. I think Well, first of all, with great affection, obviously, but also I think my father gave me, bequeathed to me, a great reverence for medical science. He was about as opposite to the personality of Howes as one could imagine. He was the most polite and gentle and easygoing of men, and would have gone to great lengths to make his patients feel attended to and heard and sympathized with. And he probably would have been somewhat horrified at Howes's behavior, but at the same time, he had a sort of steely honesty about medical and psychological truth, that there are certain things, one must be humble in the face of facts. And he was not someone who would allow sentiment to cloud an issue. And if a truth had to be spoken, he would speak it. And he would, I think he would have approved of House's scientific courage, if not his social skills. I think he would have approved of some elements of House. As I think a lot of doctors do, actually. I think some, of course, feel that House is giving them a bad name, but most, I think, feel, well, yes, actually, that those are, on occasion, things that we have wanted to say or felt but cannot say, because we are constrained by the possibility of lawsuits or being punched in the face or whatever it might be. But sometimes patients can drive you absolutely insane with the way that they withhold information, or they won't take medication that you've given them, or they won't follow their instructions, and that sort of thing.
So what was your audition like when you were auditioning to play Howes?
Well, it's one of the very rare times I've actually got a role from auditioning. I'm not a good auditioner, but this was a role I did. I knew, even though I only had a couple of scenes, I felt that there was something in this, something very substantial in this, and I wanted to do it well. And I worked very hard at it. And I came to Los Angeles, and I booked into a hotel room, and I paced up and down in that hotel room for a couple of days, just doing these two scenes over and over and over and over, and adjusting, because I was determined that this was not going to be one of those auditions where I walked out and smacked my forehead and said, oh, damn it, why did I do it like that? I wanted to do what I wanted to do, and at least leave and say, well, that's how I think it should be, and if they don't like that, then that's their business. But I, at least I did what I wanted to do. So I tried to buy a cane. You can't, of course, buy a cane in Los Angeles because there are intimations of mortality there, and canes are... Oddly enough, you can buy an umbrella, which you would think would be even less appropriate in Los Angeles, but that I did buy. I bought an umbrella and used it as a cane, and I hobbled up and down in my hotel room for days and days until I knew that no matter how scared I was, I couldn't be beaten out of doing it the way I wanted to do it. I rehearsed myself into the ground, as it were.
So, I've been listening to your voice. We started off talking about how surprising it was the first time I heard you with your own British voice. we're so used to hearing you on House with an American accent. But, as you've spoken, one of the things I've noticed about your voice is that I think it's higher than House's voice, and House's voice tends to get more trapped in his throat than your voice. Can you talk about working up the voice for House, and did you do that in the audition?
I think I did in the audition, although I noticed that there was a very different tone in the clips you played that were separated by 8 years, I think. The voice arrived sort of as a consequence of my attempt to relax. The great trap for non-American actors trying to play Americans, I think, is to start thinking of Americanness as a characteristic. It isn't. It is no more a character trait than height. It is just a physical fact, and that's all there is to it. It says nothing about the psychology of a character. And you therefore have to not let it overpower the character and walk around. I'm going to walk around in an American way. That's obviously absurd. So My most deliberate and conscious effort was to relax and not push the accent. And the consequence of that was that I think it went down in pitch. Not because I wanted it to go down in pitch, but I think when I stopped pushing at the accent, it just sort of came out that way. And pretty soon I was sort of stuck with it. It varies a bit, as the show varies a lot, I think. One of the things I've always loved about House is that it skips through tones very quickly. And, you know, one's voice has to follow that to a degree.
So, you know, with House, the way you do House's voice, it's as if a lot of his dialogue was muttered under his breath or said between clenched teeth, you know, said as an aside, even when it's not really an aside, but sometimes it is an aside. It's just a very sarcastic aside that everybody hears because he's saying it loud enough for everybody. But so is that intentional on your part? And can you talk about, like, placing your voice and maybe demonstrate that a little bit?
Well, it's a sort of a dance you do with the sound recordist. You have to know that the sound recordist is working on the same, well, literally the same wavelength as your radio transmitter, but also on a sort of artistic wavelength. They're very, very good at what they do, and it's a good partnership. They have to know how you're going to place your voice, and the two of you are really working together.
But just in terms of lowering your voice and making it a little, like, more in your throat for the part?
I suppose when I'm really relaxing and not trying to... Actually, really is one of the words, is one of my sort of warm-up American words, because it has an R and L's. And R and L's are the... those are the two... the twin demons for anyone trying to do an American accent. And yes, when I start to do that, the only way I can do it is to just completely let my throat go floppy and sort of wind up down here. I don't know why. But it somehow seemed appropriate for House. I felt it was right. I felt that he had a sort of confidence, a physical confidence and a physical command that would mean that he never needed to be shrill in any way. I was actually thinking the other day that in 8 years and 180 shows that we've done, I can only think of about four occasions when House actually deliberately raised his voice. There was nothing shrill about him. He has a sort of physical confidence and a physical... He occupies a physical space in a very firm and confident way.
My guest is Hugh Laurie, the star of the medical mystery series House, which will show its final episode May 21st. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Hugh Laurie, the star of House, and next week he directs the episode. So let's talk a little bit about your British comedy. In the late 80s, I think it was the late 80s, you did a series called Blackadder, which is a comedy, and each season was a different historical period. So I want to play a clip from Blackadder. This is a scene in which you're the Prince Regent, so you're like heir to the throne. And Blackadder at this point is your butler, played by Rowan Atkinson, and you're really dressed like, I think, a fop is the right period word to use here. You've got, like, the powdered wig, the cape. You're kind of like the man about town, or at least want to be seen that way. And so here's the scene.
Ah, Blackadder. Notice anything unusual?
Yes, sir. It's 11:30 in the morning, and you're moving about. Is the bed on fire?
Well, I wouldn't know. I've been out all night. Guess what I've been doing?
Beagling, sir?
Better even than that. Sink me, Blackadder, if I haven't just had the most wonderful evening of my life.
Tell me all, sir.
Well, as you know, when I set out, I looked divine. At the party as I passed, all eyes turned.
And I dare say, quite a few stomachs.
Well, that's right. And then, these two ravishing beauties came up to me and whispered in my ear that they loved me.
And what happened after you woke up, sir?
This was no dream, Blackadder. 5 minutes later, I was in a coach, flying through the London night, bound for the ladies' home.
Oh, and which ladies' home is this? A home for the elderly, or a home for the mentally disadvantaged?
No. This was Apsley House. Do you know it?
Yes, sir. It is the seat of the Duke of Wellington. Those ladies, I fancy, would be his nieces.
Oh, so you fancy them too? Well, I don't blame you. Bravo! Oh, I spent a night of ecstasy with a pair of Wellingtons, and I loved it.
Okay, so that's my guest, Hugh Laurie, in an episode of Blackadder with Rowan Atkinson. You know, even there, you don't sound like yourself exactly, like you're doing a different voice, and there's hardly a character who'd be more opposite than House than this kind of, like, you know, brainless, vain, shallow
yes, character. Yes, it's true. It's about as far away as you could get, except for this, that... It became a common, or maybe it always was, a common tactic of House, a strategy that House used to demonstrate the vacuity of his opponent's argument was to mimic what he, in his eyes, was their stupidity, and he would play the fool in order to demonstrate how absurd their arguments are. And sometimes I found myself sort of calling upon that same idiotic set of notes that I played as Prince George, because I've always found it quite comfortable playing stupid people. Now, why would that be? I don't know, but it's felt like a natural thing for me. But it's something that House does too in a sarcastic fashion. He plays stupid sarcastically, and does it very well. I think does it successfully in terms of winning arguments.
So. I've read that you love motorcycles.
I do. Like, I love them very dearly.
And it could be a risky endeavor. You've probably had an accident or two.
difficult for me to say, because of course if I own up to having fallen off, then the insurance company on my next, if I ever have a future employer, they will start inserting clauses into my contract. But no. Terry, I've never fallen off a motorcycle. I find it an utterly secure and reliable means of transport, if you put it that way.
Okay. And I've also read that you've had, bouts of depression. And are the two related? Does like a high-speed, really kind of physical ride do anything to chase away or obscure depression?
I suppose. I suppose it might. I hadn't thought of that. One as an antidote to the other. I hadn't thought of it, but I suppose that may be true. There's the feeling of air rushing over your body at high speed. You can't not think of a sort of cleansing process going on. That things are being swept off you, and that may include thoughts, experiences, worries that you may have are being simply, almost literally, blown off your body. Which is maybe that's a good thing. Maybe there could be something to that.
So I have to ask you. Earlier, you were telling me when we were talking about pain and House's pain and pain that you experienced. You said that you used to and still sometimes do induce leg and foot cramps. And I'm just sitting here thinking, is he pulling my leg about that? Like, does he really do that, or is that a joke?
No, I'm really not. I could do it for you now.
It wouldn't make
excellent radio, I don't think. But unless I start pounding the desk in agony, then you might get a sense of it. But no, I genuinely can do that at a moment's notice, and I do. I really do. The strange thing is you can't repeat it. If you induce cramp in your foot or calf, you then have to leave it. You can't sort of do it over and over again. For some reason, there must be some strange physiological reason for that. But so I only get sort of four bites at the cherry in a day, but I quite often take them. and I just sort of ride it out. And it's a few minutes, and it's rather... I know this is making me sound so weird, isn't it?
It's weird. What can I say? It's weird.
It is, isn't it? Yes. Yes. maybe I should have said that I am actually pulling your leg. I'm not, though. No, this is the truth. This is the truth. I can't explain it. It's just one of them things.
So one of the things that you do is play music. And piano and some guitar, you sing. So I want to close with St. James Infirmary from your recent album of blues and rhythm and blues, Let Them Talk. Just tell us a little bit about what this song means to you and about the kind of piano playing that you like most.
Well, this is St. James Infirmary is a wonderful old classic song. It's actually much older than the Louis Armstrong version that I, you know, grew up loving. The theory is that it actually comes from an old English folk song, and that the St. James Infirmary of the title actually refers to what is now St. James's Palace, oddly enough. I don't know if that's true or not. It's hard to be sure. But I thought there was something rather appropriate about an old English folk song traveling to America, being reinvented, and then finding some way of bringing it back.
Okay, well, let's hear it. Hugh Laurie, thank you so much for talking with us, and good luck with The End of House and with the episode that you directed next week. And do you know what life will be like after House for you?
I have no idea. I have absolutely no idea. I still haven't really got used to the prospect of not getting up at 4:30 is the first and most delicious thing on my agenda. I'm looking forward to that. But beyond that, I have no idea. It's very exciting. Very exciting.
Well, good. I wish you the best with that. And
thank you
again so much.
Thank you, Jay. Thank you very much.
Hugh Laurie stars in the Fox TV series House. He directed next week's episode. The series finale is May 21st. Here's Hugh Laurie at the piano and singing.
I went down to St. James Infirmary, saw my baby there. She was stretched out on a long white table, this old wide world over. She won't ever find another man like me.
This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
a recent DVD release of an imported British drama has all the features of an easily promotable teen movie. It's loaded with sex and violence, it's loaded with tales of epic battles and sinister intrigue, and even the most powerful characters are in danger of being killed at any time. But, says TV critic David Bianculli, this is no new action feature for the younger set. This is a very mature drama for very mature adults. It's a reissue of a miniseries that was shown on PBS 35 years ago. It's I, Claudius, starring Derek Jacobi as the most unlikely of Roman emperors.
I, Claudius came to American television, imported from the BBC, in 1977, the same year as another ambitious long-form production, ABC's Roots, which proved to everyone that miniseries were an exciting and extremely popular new form of television. Of course, I, Claudius, shown on the PBS series Masterpiece Theater, didn't get anything close to the audience that Roots did, but it sure got a lot of attention. And a few years later, when the ABC primetime soap opera Dynasty was launched, its creators admitted openly that what they had in mind was a modern-day I, Claudius. The original I, Claudius, based on the novel by Robert Graves, covers the reigns of several Roman emperors: Augustus, Tiberius, the famously twisted Caligula, and the stuttering, limping Claudius, who narrates the entire tale, reading from his own history. "I am not yet born," he says as the TV drama begins, "but I will be, soon." The miniseries boasts impressive performances from several key British actors. Patrick Stewart, long before Star Trek The Next Generation, shows up here. So does John Hurt as a memorably unhinged Caligula. And the women, including Sean Phillips as Livia and Sheila White as Messalina, are deadlier and even more fascinating than the males. Except, that is, for Claudius. Played by Derek Jacobi, it's a performance that spans wide-eyed youth and weary old age. At first, while everyone in Rome is falling victim to the treachery of others, he survives, mostly because he's dismissed as a stuttering idiot. Well, he stutters, but he's no idiot. And the older he gets, and the more Roman purges he survives, the wiser he is at self-preservation. Once the obviously insane Emperor Caligula has declared himself a god, for example, the wrong utterance in conversation with him can lead to instant death. But Claudius, despite his stutter, manages to use his wits quickly enough to survive. Here are John Hurt as Caligula and Derek Jacobi in the role that made him a star as Claudius. Caligula begins by asking Claudius a seemingly simple question.
How many hours a night do you sleep?
Sleep? 8 or 9, I suppose.
Well, I sleep barely 3.
Do gods need more?
You think I'm mad?
Bad?
Yes, so sometimes I think that I'm going mad. I mean, do you... Oh, no, be honest with me. Has that thought ever crossed your mind?
Never. Never. Well, the idea is preposterous. You set the standard of sanity for the whole world.
Why is there all this galloping in my head, and why do I sleep so little?
Well, it's your mortal disguise. You see, the physical body is a great strain, if you're not used to it, which a god isn't. Explains, too, I think, 3 hours sleep. You see, undisguised gods ever sleep at all.
Yes. You're probably right. But then if I'm a god, which of course I am, then why didn't I think of that?
Revisiting I, Claudius after so many years is quite a treat. It's a strong reminder of how literate and ambitious the miniseries form used to be, and how much we've lost by its overall disappearance. Except that, like so many other entertainment forms, the miniseries hasn't so much gone extinct as been absorbed. It's alive and well in season-long storylines on Showtime's Homeland and Dexter, and on the lengthy narratives of AMC's Mad Men and Breaking Bad. But on television, the extended, complicated narrative began in such productions as I, Claudius. The new DVD box set from Acorn presents this beautifully, and even includes a bonus feature that, to me, is alone worth the purchase price. It's a full-length documentary from 1967 about an unfinished attempt to film I, Claudius way back in 1937. The documentary is called The Epic That Never Was, and you may have seen it on public TV several decades ago. I did, and never forgot it. It's got all the surviving footage of the aborted I, Claudius, filmed by Joseph von Sternberg, and starring Charles Laughton in the title role. Laughton was amazing, and you can tell that from even a brief taste.
Claudius will tell you how to frame your laws. Profiteering and bribery will stop. This Senate will function only in the name of Roman justice, and all of you who have acquired office dishonestly will be replaced by men who love Rome better than their purses.
How wonderful is that? And how wonderful is this 35th anniversary I, Claudius set? Not only do you get one fantastic Claudius to enjoy, you get two.
David Bianculli is founder and editor of the website TV Worth Watching and teaches TV and film history at Rowan University in New Jersey. He reviewed the 35th anniversary DVD edition of I, Claudius. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. And you can follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air and on Tumblr at nprfreshair.tumblr.com. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Melody Kramer. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
This is NPR.
Americans produce more trash than anyone else on the planet. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Edward Humes, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of the new book Garbology. For his research, he visited the largest active municipal landfill, Puente Hills in Los Angeles.
You can see the entire Los Angeles basin by standing on a mountain of its trash.
Join us.